Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating, letting people know about the program. We really appreciate it. Often we get messages and emails from new listeners, so please do spread the word. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be hearing about a mad way to build a contraceptive that self-assembles inside you, and it may avoid the need for daily pills or invasive procedures and stirrups. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @newstalkscience. Before we get into the podcast, you might know that I've started delivering courses on using AI to get through your to-do list, get things done. We have three events coming up in person, an AI bootcamp in Dublin and Cork, and a special online focus for HR, recruitment and training. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, getstartedai.com is where you'll find out more details. All right, time to look at what's in the news this week. And we're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and medic and immunologist, Dr. Laura Duggan. Our first story, Ruth, has to do with AI, of course.
Yeah, and this is AI in a field where I think many people see real and immediate potential for benefit, and that's the area of diagnostics in medicine. So this is work that's been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, AI. It now has its own journal for medicine, wow. And it comes from researchers in Cambridge. And they've been looking at celiac disease. And I'm sure everybody has had the experience, either themselves or they know someone who's gone through trying to get a diagnosis for celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder that's triggered by eating gluten. And it's pretty common, about 1% of the population have it. But it's one of these conditions that has a wide range of symptoms. So, you know, a lot of people get pain, diarrhea, rashes, weight loss, but it can be quite difficult to diagnose. And really the gold standard for diagnosis, you have to get a biopsy of your small intestine, and a pathologist has to look at that biopsy to see kind of the condition of your small intestine. And there's little small hair-like structures inside the intestine called villi, which absorb all the nutrients from your food. And the pathologist has got to assess the condition of those. And you can get scored sort of 1 to 4, depending on how severe the condition looks. But there's
how
a big
backlog. How
do you
scan for that?
So it's a biopsy. You take it's a slide.
Oh, it has to be a biopsy.
It's a biopsy.
You can't stick
something
up or down.
But even with biopsy, no. There's challenges because different parts of the gut can be in different conditions. So sometimes people have to go back and have more than one biopsy. And obviously there is a level of subjectivity depending on the pathologist looking at it. And of course, for a lot of this is a kind of chronic condition for most people. So you probably get pushed to the back of the queue if maybe someone who has a suspected cancer scan needed, you know, that's going to be much more urgent. So there can be long waiting lists for people to get these tests. So researchers at Cambridge have developed this new machine learning algorithm to look at these biopsies. And the AI was trained on just under 3,500 biopsies from 4 different NHS hospitals. And they looked at data from 5 different scanning machines, looking at different companies that produce this technology. And what they found was that the AI demonstrated sensitivity of over 95%. So it actually identified those with the disease 95% of the time. And in terms of specificity, which is identifying those without the disease, the specificity was 98%. So this matches an experienced pathologist, but delivers a result almost instantly compared to 1 or 2 pathologists having to have a look at a scan, and that can take weeks or months. And so this has huge potential to really cut waiting times for people waiting for a diagnosis.
You still have to get the biopsy, though. I thought when you said this is about AI in celiac disease, I'd hoped that they'd found some other way of identifying it. So you still have to get the biopsy. It's just a cue to get someone to look at your scan takes so long because there's so much demand for these experts to go through them and go, yes, this is celiac disease.
You do at the moment, but I think that is the way we are going to see some of this innovation in medicine. You know, totally transforming the way you do something can be much more difficult to taking a process that actually is well regulated and people understand and people can buy into, and getting a step of it done by AI first. But I mean, who knows what will come down the line, you know, in terms of maybe being able to use internal cameras that you take in a pill or other kinds of technologies that might get you the image that you need. But part of this is about clinician buy-in, it's about patient buy-in, it's about the infrastructure in hospitals that can do it. But I think there are some potential quick and easy wins here in some of this diagnostics of scans. And we're already seeing the FDA approving some AIs for things like looking at breast cancer biopsies and other things. So it's definitely a place where we can get efficiencies.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, ideally, you'd have a human in the loop to say, yes, that's right, that's wrong. Because afterwards, if someone finds out it was AI that misdiagnosed them as opposed to a human, I wonder, would they be as forgiving? You know, would we see more lawsuits as a result of it being AI versus humans? I imagine you might. Our second story, Lara, is about sharks and the first sharks that ever swam.
So as I was aware, that was the only noise up until this point that sharks were able to make. And I mean, if you'd ask me, could sharks make noise? I would say, yes, they could make that noise, but no, they could make no others. But this is new research that has just come out of an oceanographic institute in New Zealand. So they had separately been studying juvenile rig sharks, which are a small bottom-dwelling shark that are native to New Zealand. And actually what they noticed when they took these sharks out to study them is that they made a noise, and I think we should be able to play it now. So that is the noise that these sharks were found to make, and it is the first time it's ever been identified that sharks can make a noise. And it's very interesting because as they continued to handle the sharks and the sharks became more used to handling, they stopped making this clicking sound. And they think it's potentially a sound that the sharks are making because they are distressed. So whether it's to warn off a predator or not, they're not sure. Now, the sharks can't hear this noise. They don't have the ability to actually hear the sound. So if it is a sound, yeah, they haven't got the ability to hear that particular level of sound. So but they do know that one of their main predators, a fur seal, can hear this type of sound. But the thing that I find a little bit less exciting about this is, strictly speaking, it doesn't appear that they're making the sound in the way we would assume you or I or anything else would make a sound. So sharks don't have swim bladders, and some fish that can make sounds are believed to make it via their swim bladders. But what they think is actually happening here is these sharks have very flat teeth. They use them to crush crabs. It's kind of a pavement type dentition or just this very flat teeth. And they think actually it's them clacking their teeth together very quickly and in a very loud way. And they actually measured this at 155 decibels, which they say is comparable to a shotgun blast, which I kind of found totally insane. But there is a theory that this is them, whether it's a stress response or an intentional response of them warning off a predator. It is the first time it has been recorded that sharks have been able to independently make noises, which is very interesting.
It would make sense that they don't know they're making the noise if they can't hear it. That kind of makes sense to me. Like if they're making this, if they're making that noise to communicate at all, then they should be able to sense it. If they can't sense it, it might just be a noise they're making, but not intentionally or to communicate.
But it's hard to know because, yes, they are not able to hear it. They function through electroreceptors and smell and far more than they would ever do anything through sound. Their hearing is very bad. But if you are a shark that has been predated by a seal and you have accidentally done something with your mouth that has made the seal go away, why would you not continue to do that? So it could be intentional, but maybe they just don't know what it is that they're doing to drive away the fur seal, or maybe it's completely accidental.
Great. More research required. Our third story, Ruth, is about why we don't remember being a baby. And I'd like to preface this story by saying, I don't remember being a teenager practically. Like, I have such a bad memory of my childhood. I generally think I had a good one. I don't think I'm suppressing anything. Although this is probably not the time to explore that right now. But
lie down, Jonathan. Make yourself comfortable.
Yeah. It's on the couch. But we don't remember anything from when we were a baby till about two, right?
Well, actually, probably about the first half of your third year is when most studies have said people can start to remember things. But look, it's very complicated because, of course, we get shown pictures of things that happened when we're younger and we get told about things that happened when we were younger. So working out what's an actual memory can be a real challenge. But yes, as you say, the dogma has been that we can't remember anything from before about the age of three, and that we really start forgetting anything we know between three and seven by about age seven. And this is actually called infantile amnesia. So it's a fairly well-established bit of neuroscience. But what is it about putting kids into MRI scanners? Because that's what these people did. Again, they must be gluttons for punishment. They're researchers from Yale, and this work was published in Science this week. And they got 26 infants aged between 4 months and 2 years. And they used MRI to measure the activity in their hippocampus as these children looked at images of things like faces and objects and scenes. And then after they had been shown those the first time, they were re-shown a set of images after a period of time, and they were either shown the same images again or new ones. But what they found was they spent more time paying attention to the things that they had seen before. And when the scientists looked at the activity going on in their brain, they found that if there was more activity in the hippocampus the first time they saw the image, they also seemed to correlate with focusing on it for longer when they saw it later on. And they are suggesting this is a sign of memories being encoded. And the reason why is because that hippocampal activity is what's associated with what's called episodic memory, the idea that we can remember specific events and experiences. So this does sort of challenge the notion that infants can't form memories because their hippocampus was underdeveloped, which was the theory before. And it does suggest that perhaps memories can be encoded even in those first months of life. And there are some animal studies that have suggested the same thing and suggested that it's really that we can't retrieve those memories. It's not that they are never made. But you know, certainly that we still don't know, because many of these children can't talk yet. They can't really tell us what they're remembering. So it's a tough area to do research in, but certainly it suggests that you can code memories from very, very early on.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if something, like if at age two and a half, maybe, when's the earliest you can actually reason about memories? Maybe three. Three? Would you add three?
Yeah, three and a half kind of tends to be what people report they can remember.
Yeah. And I suppose they're unreliable witnesses, let's be honest, a 3.5 year old. I have had two in my time, and I wouldn't trust their memories, even if they were sure. I would say probably that didn't happen. So I'm not sure. I think it is a difficult area to subject.
I mean, memory itself, I think, you know, it's challenging. As you say, for many of us, you do struggle to remember things very specifically. What we do know is that for people who have more meaningful events are easier to remember. So when they have done experiments on kids, when they say to them, like, do you remember when we went to the zoo and you had pizza and you did this? But if you can lead the witness, and they will remember things that didn't happen. But, you know, maybe that happens to all of us.
I do that all the time. I was telling this story for about 10 years that Coolio cut me off in a toilet in Harry Houdini's mansion in LA. And I would tell this story all the time. And then I was hanging out with a guy who was there, and he said, that was me. I got cut off from Coolio in Harry Houdini's mansion in LA. And that is a true story, but it turns out it's not my true story. But I could have sworn it had happened to me. Anyway.
Sounds like a dream, Johnny.
It does sound like a dream. And Mila Jovovich was there. And anyway, our final story, Lara, has to do with cheese and cholesterol. And I'm going to be the person on the bus and put up my hand and say, I don't really know anything about cholesterol. Cholesterol, to me, kind of feels like something we worried about in the 80s. And now it's not so much of a thing. But I have a feeling that's not true.
I am so glad you are not in charge of public health for Ireland. Cholesterol, believe it or not, is just as big a problem as it always was, and probably a bigger problem because of the obesity epidemic. But this is research that has just come out of UCD. And what they did was they have previously published two randomized control trials, which they have done an analysis of. They took patients who were considered to be obese, so BMI of over 25 and age over 50, and they split them into two groups. And in one group, they gave them cheese, 120 grams of cheddar cheese every day. And in the other group, they gave them deconstructed cheese. And what that is essentially the components or ingredients that is required to make cheese, but in a different form. So they gave them 49 grams of butter, 30 grams of casein powder, which is the primary protein that's found in milk and therefore cheese, and a calcium supplement. And then they measured their cholesterol. And what they found is that in both groups, cholesterol was reduced by the cheese. But in the male group, cholesterol was reduced by both things, the deconstructed cheese and the cheese. But in the women only, the cheese reduced the cholesterol, but the deconstructed cheese did not. Now, first of all, this seems bats because it is a significant source of saturated fat and you would think it would make the cholesterol go up. So that, first of all, is the bit that seems a bit crazy. But it is actually quite well published that cheese can reduce cholesterol. And we're talking about the, I suppose, what we would say, quote unquote, bad cholesterol, which is the LDL cholesterol.
But wait. What exactly is cholesterol? Because we haven't really covered that. Like, what is it?
So cholesterol are what we would call lipids, so essentially fats. So it comes as, when you measure it, it comes as total cholesterol. Then you have LDL, which is low density lipoprotein, and that's the type of fats that are laid down inside your arteries that make plaques, that narrow your arteries, that end up causing atherosclerotic disease or what can lead to cardiovascular disease or heart disease. And HDL, which is high density lipoprotein, helps to remove the bad cholesterol from your arteries, bring it to the liver and have it broken down. And it's known that animal fats are a high source of LDL or bad cholesterol, and vegetable fats are a much higher source of HDL. So not all cholesterol is bad. Not all cholesterol is created equal, as it were. But high levels of LDL cholesterol are bad for you. So it's bad stuff.
Can I ask you, was this blue cheese, Swiss cheese, cheddar cheese?
And they even said that the name of the company that it comes from, as did they say the name of the company that the butter came from, and they are well-known Irish companies, which was lovely. But the thing that was interesting about this is the concept that it's the way in which the fats are presented to your body, and they call this the dairy matrix. So they think that if fats come in cheese, then it is not going to cause you a problem with the cholesterol. But if it comes in a more broken down form, then for women, especially from this research, it will. So it's kind of mind-boggling. I don't fully understand how it works, but they are suggesting that the way you see this dairy fat matters. So you can't just eat loads and loads of butter and assume it's going to be the same as loads and loads of cheese. So I'm still going to eat both.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much for that. Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Now imagine you could take a contraceptive that would last for months without daily pills or invasive procedures, and you wouldn't really have to do anything. It would just sort of self-assemble right inside of you. Dr. Giovanni Traverso is associate professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT, and his team have been working on a contraceptive that does just that. He joins me now. Giovanni, welcome to the program. Let's, as we always do on this program, start with the basics. What are we trying to do with a contraceptive, and what are the various ways we can do that?
So thanks so much, Jonathan, for having me on. And maybe I think it would be helpful to maybe take a step back. And this really is a challenge for women that want to engage with contraceptives, but also for other patients, whether it be patients who are receiving treatment for HIV, TB, or neuropsychiatric conditions. And it's really thinking about, you know, how do we make it easier for patients and people in general to receive medication? And what we know is that we can essentially have depots, so long-acting systems, but usually we have to implant those either through surgical means or really big needles. And so what we focused on was really a way of doing that through a very small needle. And exactly like you pointed out, where you inject it and inside of your body, it forms that solid depot that is able to give you that long-acting medication. Hopefully that gives you a little bit more background, but also I think it's important to appreciate that it actually impacts many conditions.
For sure, actually, and we'll get into all of those. But in terms of contraceptive, as you say, some you could take a regular pill, but you have to remember to take that pill. And we did a feature not so long ago about a cream you rub into your shoulders, which really interesting way of applying medication for this particular purpose. You can, of course, use a condom. All of these ways of using a contraceptive have their issues. And your work has gone, I suppose, down a really unusual route in that you're looking at sort of a mechanical way, in a way, of delivering hormones or drugs in a very different way. So talk to me about this method of drug delivery and why you think it might work as an alternative.
Well, what we recognize, particularly in contraception, is that women really want to have control over their fertility. And in doing so, or in thinking about this process, ensuring that, for example, they have the capacity to self-administer, the medication, you know, is an important factor. And what we know with respect to injections is that small injections are generally more easily self-administered. And we know that, for example, from insulin, for example, and other injectables that are readily available. Now, for these other medications like contraceptives, there are long-acting systems, but they require either a surgical procedure or a large needle. And so we focused on that aspect, but then also in doing so, we developed a liquid system that is injected through a very small needle and then inside of the body forms this solid, essentially you could imagine or think of it as like a tablet, and that tablet as such can then release the medication over a prolonged period from months to even years.
I was intrigued by this this word of self-assembly. And perhaps you might explain what exactly happened. So is this some way of encapsulating a drug, and then you inject it into a particular site. Take me from start to finish how this works, please.
Absolutely. So with respect to the medications or drugs used for contraception, we focused on a very common one called levonorgestrel. And this drug can essentially go into solution, and we create essentially a solution that has that drug, and that solution is actually a solvent, okay? And so it is actually a material or a liquid that the medication essentially will go into that solution at a higher concentration. So I just want you to maybe think of sugar and water where, you know, you can add the sugar, it'll dissolve. But similarly here, we have the solvent that will accept the drug. And then when we inject that solvent, but which by the way has been used in many other medications, so we know it to be safe, what happens in the body is that that solvent essentially is cleared by the body, but what is left behind is the drug. And so as that process of that solvent being cleared by the body, the drug is self-assembling, ordering itself into essentially that small tablet or, you know, solid inside of the body.
I'm trying to picture this and I'm struggling. So it kind of melts away as it dissolves into the natural environment around it, and what's left is the powder of the tablet. Or just help me with this.
Yeah, I think an analogy, you know, could be, for example, a cup of tea with a lot of sugar. If you let it dry, you will see that sugar essentially crystallize at the bottom.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've ever experienced that, but if you come and look at an old cup of tea, you will see that has a lot of sugar, you will see that dry. And that's, you know, I would say a similar process where the solvent, in that case, water, disappears and leaves behind that solid that becomes a crystal or a set of crystals. So similarly here, we have another solvent that essentially is cleared, and what is left behind is a solid, in this case, the drug, the levonorgestrel.
Why don't you just inject the tablet?
Because of the size. So that's the challenge that we were trying to address as well, in that we can, and certainly others have injected tablets and included tablets, but then one needs to either, you know, create an incision and then place it and then suture. And that's what makes it, you know, a lot harder, because then self-administration isn't really possible today.
Oh, so this is what you mean by self-assembly. You're talking about the particles of this active drug seeking each other out in a site there that it's useful, and then slowly releasing those molecules into the bloodstream, those hormones in this particular case, to create the desired biological effect.
That's right. Exactly.
Why do these particles want to seek each other out? And is that something you've engineered, or is it something they naturally do?
So this particular drug, and there are other similar drugs like it, is hydrophobic. And so it likes to be with itself. And so it is that hydrophobic sort of property that really drives the coalescence, or essentially that self-assembly or aggregation of the drugs. And so as that solvent is disappearing, all of these crystals come together. So that's sort of inbuilt essentially into the properties of the drug itself.
How is it injected and where? And how do you make sure that drug is in the correct site before it assembles?
So That assembly and that process happens relatively quickly, on the order of tens of seconds to minutes. And so as far as the site, there are some common sites that women, for example, you know, for decades now have chosen or identified as sites that, you know, they feel having depots like this are comfortable. So, for example, the inside of the arm is one of them, sometimes the outside of the arm. But, you know, I think for this system, part of our future plans are really delineating the optimal sites, both from a comfort perspective and also from a drug release perspective. And so certainly we'll look at the similar sites that have been used in the past and then, you know, use that data to guide sort of the optimal site selection.
And so what typically makes a good site for a drug releasing hormone? Is it somewhere that is, you know, that has access to the bloodstream, that isn't involved in a lot of movement?
Yes, exactly. I think you want a site that has a good blood supply and where there isn't, you know, the potential for significant trauma, for example, just because trauma in itself could affect, you know, that tablet as such. And so the inside of the arm, for example, is a site that has been used historically for many of these depots in the past. Or similar one, I should say.
Why? Because I know, and we've heard about these slow release drugs. And I guess one of the questions I would have is how do they ensure that the flow of this hormone is regular and not all at once or not at all?
No, great question. So it has to do in this particular case, because drug delivery, the way we do drug delivery can vary depending on the drug. But in this case, the drug itself, because of those properties I was describing, will essentially be absorbed at a very specific rate. And so we can control what that rate is essentially by the amount that we inject at the beginning. And so that's how, in this particular situation, that drug release occurs. But I think something related to this is sometimes women may want to end the contraceptive. And so one thing that this system allows is actually for one to go in and retrieve the solid object. Whereas with other depots, other injections, it's not possible. And so that's also, I should, you know, just want to highlight another feature that is inbuilt into the system, again, because of that self-assembly that occurs with the drug.
There's a lot of work being done in contraceptive science these days, it seems. Why is that? Obviously, speaking from the position of a parent who doesn't require or need contraception anymore, it surprising to hear so much work advancing it. And that's, I suppose, because it just doesn't work for a lot of people and especially a lot of women.
Yes, and I think it's really about, you know, generating and having options, right? I think there isn't one solution for everybody. Everyone has different needs. And so, you know, this is work supported by the Gates Foundation. And, you know, they're heavily focused in sub-Saharan Africa and also Southeast Asia, and have recognized that empowering women to have control over their fertility can really transform women's lives as they seek education, professional sort of development, to really have control over that, the timing of conception, et cetera. And so that's my sense, at least, as to why there's tremendous investment, is because of the recognition that empowering women to really have control can really transform the lives of the woman, but also of their families as well.
You talked about other potentials for this sort of medicine. Are there other other particular conditions that really struggle to reach the desired site, that often require invasive surgery, that really might benefit from this rather unusual self-assembly approach to medicine?
So there are a few conditions that having essentially long-acting injectables could really transform what we can do for patients. One of those areas or one of those diseases is tuberculosis, where the treatment courses are long. And if someone fails to take the medication, then one can essentially have resistant organisms that makes it a lot harder now to treat. So that's one area. And also along with TB is HIV. And In addition, another sort of big area is neuropsychiatric conditions, where the condition in itself can impair the ability of the person to take the medication. So it's another way of really helping patients, ensuring that they're getting medications that really help the condition. So those are some of the key areas, and certainly we're looking at all of those, you know, with this platform.
Right. And I think that makes sense, because one of the facts I learned from a previous interview was that, you know, typical medicine adherence is like 50%, that 50% of people take their medication the way they're supposed to. Maybe it's even as low as 25%. It's very, very low. And I guess when it comes to contraception or, you know, neurological conditions, HIV, these are things where there are big consequences if you don't take your medication every day as required. So they seem like perfect targets for this sort of mechanism.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right.
Well, really interesting speaking with you, Dr. Giovanni Traversi, who's Associate Professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. And we were talking, if you remember, to Joe Roman, who was talking about the great whale pee funnel, as he called it, which is this essential cycle of biodiversity that whales bring along with them because of the nutrients they pass in their urine. And he reckons it has a massive global impact. Jane says, are there other creatures whose waste has a similar impact on their environment? So there are in their environments, Jane. So elephants are massive. They're big spreaders of seeds. You've got birds, of course, bats, and they would have big impact on their environment. But in terms of a global effect, there's nothing quite like the whale because they travel such extraordinary distances. Another person says, would it have any long-term effects on the ocean if whale populations were to decline and they provided less pee? Well, absolutely, considering they are so relevant to a lot of these ecosystems, and we heard that they actually, you know, are responsible, just the we is responsible for lots of mini ecosystems. You've got phytoplankton, which are really depend on the nutrients in that. Phytoplankton declines. You've got a problem with carbon fixing because they're really responsible in that. A lot of animals feed on that phytoplankton. So it's it's one thing leading to another. Biodiversity, ocean chemistry, all of these things would be affected if whales held their pee. And we were also talking about public speaking. Chris McDonald is the University of Cambridge, and he's created this VR app to help you conquer your fear of public speaking. I wasn't fully convinced by it, but Derek says, I find it so irrational that the things we have fears about, my fear of heights only developed in adulthood. I think fear in heights doesn't count as a phobia, does it? I mean, the fear of heights is a rational sort of fear. I mean, I guess you could have an irrational sort of fear of, being in a safe building and being up high, but that's grounded in a bit of sense, I think. Sometimes people are afraid of like swimming in swimming pools in case there's a hidden section in which sharks come in. Like that's actually a real phobia. I think that's a bit of an irrational one. But Derek says, I wonder, is the seed planted as a child or if it's more common to develop these fears as you grow up and overthink? I don't know. We should probably ask Chris that. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks for your questions. And thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.